Hey, welcome back to the Intellectual Bouncy House. That's what I'm calling it these days, known as the Rhetoric Warriors Podcast. We are finding the good stuff about public talk and getting up in public and working with people, and we're taking down the bad stuff. I'm Dr. Dan, rhetorician, late night comedy writer, founder of Rhetoric Warriors. The podcast does three things. I talk to comedians about their careers and their politics, and lately I've been uncensoring them so that they can actually do the material on this podcast that they can't do in clubs because of all the blowback, and that's been fun. I convert conservatives because they concern me. I think they need some reorienting to some basic American ethical principles. And I talk to persuasion pros and rhetoricians. I also have a new book out, 21 Colosseums of Persuasion. May do a podcast about that pretty soon. It's been fun to watch people react to that. This is another episode of Persuasion Pros. My guest today, longtime corporate trainer, which I always find fascinating because it's sort of like an embedded educator or rhetorician inside an organization. Like even if it's a consultant, it's somebody flying in like Star Wars to do some work on the Death Star and then flying out. The corporation tries to improve itself from within. I think that's an aesthetic that's become fairly normal in corporate life. So we're going to talk it up quite a bit about this particular niche because this guy's been doing it for a long time. And I assume he's a super expert at this point. Am I right, Bob? Are you a super expert?
Well, that's the word around the hood. So probably we'll go with that concept.
All right. Bob Lewis, everybody right here. Bob Lewis in Austin.
Hey, everybody.
Although you're not in Austin anymore.
No, in College Station. Talk about, you know, changing people from conservatives. So move from a very kind of out there community in Austin to a community of great people, very, very, very conservative. But being closer to Grandson, I live in South College Station, so it kind of ekes a little bit out of that. So, yeah. So here I am. Thanks for having me today.
Yeah, I talked to a professor a couple of weeks ago from A&M. She'd been there for 20 years. And I was telling her how sometimes I bemoan the fact that like just your neighborhood, if one neighborhood of 25, 30 houses were just everyone was populated with somebody super cool that you really liked, you'd never really have to leave your block. And she was like, well, I kind of have that here in College Station. Like everybody on my block is a professor and I really like them. And I'm like, well, good for you. Very nice.
Cool.
So run your background a little bit. Tell everybody.
Sure. Just kind of orient everybody I won't start from birth, so I'll just start. You know, I always wanted to help the underdog, and so I became a high school special ed teacher right out of college. And you know, I went into a very tough situation, and kids, you know, first day threw desk at me, and I thought, well, I'm not going to teach verbs today. We're going to do something totally different.
Right.
And what's interesting is that I think it was just a plan for me to maybe move into what I'm doing today because I saw all kinds of human behaviors, very raw and authentic. And I learned a lot about myself too. One, I really learned how to duck when a desk was flying in my head. It was awesome, you know? And, but you know, from there, I kind of stayed in education 16 years. I, you know, taught fifth grade science and I always was one of those weird teachers bringing weird stuff up. Like, you know, I taught The Hobbit in fifth grade and they're like, oh, we can't do this. Why not? There's really cool stuff in there. I taught The Hobbit, the book. I threw away the book.
Why was The Hobbit too much?
Oh, because they thought it didn't stand in the normal standard lane of curriculum. But it was reading, and I figure if kids can read and we can have a journey. So, you know, for me, I was always one of those teachers that brought up some weird, cool stuff. And they're like, here's Lewis doing that again. But, you know,
isn't that weird, like education become that where it's like a person who has a progressive mind that's trying to really reach out and gather new materials, which is what makes education fun, seems odd in that context.
Oh, it is odd. And, you know, for me, it was some great content and the kids were so excited. I mean, I remember watching, I taught mythology too. I mean, I was like, you know, I showed I was at the Titans. There was mythology. In one scene, the woman was breastfeeding a kid and they came in, oh, how can you show that? And the kids said, my mom does that. What's the big deal? You know? And so, you know, for me, it's like, I evolved into it, became a principal and just did, you know, there's kids are pretty cool. They're easier than us adults. You know, adults, kids are sometimes better behaved. It's just maybe adults, only thing difference is our clothes fit a little bit better. You know, everything's hanging on young kids. And so,
interesting to me, like that you started in that and you had that sort of base experience, because, you know, I was in university education for 20 years. And it's much looser than, you know, elementary and high school and that kind of stuff. But it's still the just the strictures I felt on me all the time of don't say this, this is problematic, as opposed to like what you think, like you're going to become a teacher and you're like, I get to explore the world with people.
Right. Right. And then people say no. But, you know, for me, it's like, you know, what's crazy is that I found in with kids, and you talk about comedy and everything, where we laughed in class, you know, my test scores kind of went up. And because, you know what, they were engaged in it and they remembered. In fact, I ran across a student on Facebook, Hillary, and she said to me, she says, you know, the class was so much fun, but I still remember stuff. I remember mythology and the Hobbit and how we acted it out. We ran outside and we figured out, we look at the sky and look for aliens. But she goes, I remember, I read better, you know, because I got to laugh. And so, you know, for me, as I have many different careers, I know I'm supposed to introduce myself. You know, I went from there to, I quit being a principal and I went to.
I'll pull you off your rail the whole time.
Excellent.
Something interesting. Then I want to hear more about that. Cause I really like this idea of, cause people don't understand if they haven't been in education, just how conservative and whitewashed and slowed down education gets in so many places, and that you have to fight in order to educate kids. And that's just exactly the opposite of what people think they're getting when they're going into that career.
Sometimes your dreams are dashed away, but I figure I'm not gonna let them take my energy away from that, because, you know, kids really want to learn, and they don't want to sit and listen to somebody. For me, it's this whole model of I learn by movement. And I found out a lot of kids learn by movement. Adults learn by movement. You see people fidgeting in classrooms and all of a sudden they're standing up, and some people, you need to sit down. I said, no, they move and learn. You know, I mean, it's not a complicated concept.
I just remember sports day at my kid's school and all the kids outside all day long. And I'm like, this is what it should be every day. Like, this is clearly natural environment to these kids. Like, you can throw math at them or whatever you want while they're moving. But yeah, it's not.
It's crazy. So, you know, I got this concept. I quit being a principal and I went into, I was a headhunter, not an actual headhunter, but, you know, I look for people for jobs. I'd go find a job placement. I find a person and match them. I thought, oh, that's kind of cool. Plus it paid a lot more. You know, I thought, my wife is like, what are you doing? And then all of a sudden I was doing it, making lots of money. She goes, okay, you can do that. Yeah. You know, I sat on the phone all day and just matched people up. It's kind of like the early matchmaker.com.
And that was your second job, headhunter?
Headhunter. And then, you know, from there, I worked for a company called Nolan Human Resource in Omaha, Nebraska. And we actually wrote behavioral-based questions where we would ask a question to top talent and try to figure out how do you, a lot of times companies hire for skill, but they hire for behavior. But this guy taught me, shouldn't we hire for behavior? Because that's what happens with teams and everything. So I actually worked for about 4 or 5 years with the company, and they connect somebody out. And we actually wrote questions. I would go interview. I'd write a question, interview the top talent with that behavior. So let's say I'm measuring responsibility. I would actually go out and interview people who are responsible. This is crazy. They'd give us the answers to the questions. Because a lot of times when you're interviewing people, you go, oh, are you a good listener? Yeah, I'm a good listener. Oh, and you write it down. He is a good listener. Then you hire him. 6 months later, he's Satan's spawn.
Right.
He doesn't know how to listen. I mean, it's not anything. I mean, he's not a bad person. He just doesn't have that behavior. And so that's kind of where, you know, that was standing point right there. I thought, I kind of like adult learning. Because adult learning, I saw where I attended adult learning, sucked.
Right.
They show a PowerPoint, they assess at the end and ask you, what did you learn? Well, maybe not squat, you know? And so I took a job with UT, crazy place, and I was in charge of the leadership and learning and development. And I started adults walking down, you know, the first time it was amazing. I became a corporate trainer. I said something and I saw a lady write something down. I said, "What are you writing?" She goes, "I'm writing what you said." Of course, my ego shot, I know stuff, but yeah, maybe not squat. So, you know, just there, when I started doing that, and then I went to Texas Parks and Wildlife and ran their e-learning and leadership program and for all the parks and everything. And it just connected with me that people, like we are today, I'm sure you and I, Dan, are learning. People need to learn every day. And that's kind of
where, I'm going to teach you something real quick.
Absolutely.
When you hit your table that comes across the microphone.
Oh, sorry about that, sir.
Now I've learned a production technique.
I have. All right. See, learn every day. You see, I learned through movement. So
nice. Well, yeah, I like the movement.
Yeah, but I won't tap the table anymore. Thank you, Dan.
So I'm curious. Let's go back a little bit, because this is great that you're running the background. I want to pull out a couple of things, like the behavioral interviewing stuff. Like that to me is when you find little pieces of software that people intuitively go, "Oh, that's a correct answer," versus what we've been doing. Like those are just so valuable. I did a little research on behavioral interviewing because Matt pointed out that you had an expertise in that. And just the idea that it has like the little star system, that it's a very followable piece of software that you can go, "Oh, situation, task, result, what, mm-hmm. Action, result." And then you can ask much better questions and you get much better information. And that little software things like that, I love as a rhetorician, because it's a designed piece of script that will work over and over and over again in situations. And that's what rhetoricians do. They try to come up with a theory that lets you set up a very specific technique that then gets you more effective results. Mm.
Absolutely. And I think in the end game, if you do a process, and I have my own process I use, that you get a lot of reliability and validity. And people, I had a company the other day say, using the process I use, "I haven't had a bad hire in 11 years.
Wow.
And you know me, that's heartwarming, because what they said is what they said in the interview matched their action 6 months later. And because I really, as an interviewer, I just asked questions, I wrote things down. And then we went around the table and said, "Who do you like?" So around the table, and everybody said, "I like this person." But it was not measured, like you said, on a process. And behavior can be in a more of a process. Because it's hard to find good people some days at the end of the game.
Yeah, and I'm fascinated right now with the concept of process. And this, again, it goes back to my training, but this idea of being able to assess your process. Like I tell people when I do the convert conservatives, and I also convert millennials, because I think anybody that's been pushed into a heightened state is kind of a problem in a democracy. But it's the idea that I don't care where you land. I don't care what you believe. It doesn't really matter to me at all. I care about how you got there. And that's process. So when you say, like I posted a thing today about part of the problem in our democracy right now is if you have a public discourse stream where people need, like if people need good information in order to know who to vote for, like democracies don't work unless you have information. If you're voting for somebody you've never heard of until you walk into the voting booth, that's a bad system. And that's kind of our system. But non-knowledge is at least better than like having a public discourse stream that doesn't give us pure knowledge now, but it also gives us garbage. Like we let people dump as much garbage into it as they want. There's nobody standing near the bank going, "Hey, don't dump that asbestos into my river." Like it's completely open. And so people get bad information in the process itself, and that leads them to bad conclusions. And then you can't go fix the conclusions because the process is broken. Like when I see stuff like your behavioral interviewing or things that I know that I'm sure you've outlined and that you teach, you're handing out good processes to the world.
Absolutely. And, I think, you throw the politics in there. I love that too, is that, I don't know what I am anymore, but I have a friend who always says, "Can't we just get along and can't we just find the right people?" And to me is my big hunt. And this whole world of training is what do we have in common? Because we're so trying to figure out how we're so different. And I, what I have found in any process, behavioral interview, and communication strategies I teach is that finding out what people do well in the organization and use that part of your process, because a lot of times you're training, you can find it with peer-to-peer stuff going on. They can write the questions. They can interview each other and find out, what are we looking for in the next candidate? Well, we're looking for somebody who's responsible, creative, and innovative. So what does that mean? So they send people off to write their questions pretty quickly, and they write questions, which may be dumb, sorry. And all of a sudden at the end of the day, they just hire people they like. I know, kind of going back to that, but for me, is, you know, they, on our end of interviewing, we need to get better, because smart candidates look at you like, what the heck are you doing asking me that question? If you could open a manhole cover and measure it, what would you do it after? Well, maybe it's a good question, but if you don't know what you're asking or what it predicts, why ask a stupid question?
Right.
You can get me all started on behavioral interview. I can talk all day on that. It's my love.
I do like to come back around. Like, my first interview with people usually in the podcast is about sort of career and kind of who you are. And then a lot of times I will circle back around and pick out areas of expertise like that, because it's, I'm sure it's fascinating. There's so much depth to this stuff once you've spent. That's why, like, I interviewed you at the beginning. I asked if you were a super expert. And I don't know if you know that concept, but like, somebody explained it to me once, like that they were in a very complex oil and gas deal across two different continents. And there were 25 lawyers in the whole place and on both sides, and they were going at it for days. And finally, somebody was like, hey, we should bring in such and such. And it was some woman who had done a particular type of work. And she walked in and fixed it all within like an hour, because she was a super expert in that particular thing. And when you find super experts in an organization or in training or education, they just have new information that nobody else has figured out yet. And it's fascinating to watch it just kind of shred everything.
Yeah. This concept I have with engineers, because, you know, they're pretty brilliant, but I'm pretty brilliant in this area. And they're like, it's kind of a basic concept that I never thought of, taking questions and interviewing my top talent to listen, to write the question, the answers to the questions. And to you, yeah. So to answer the question, you know, that's probably, you know, I'm not a master, jack of all trades, but I am, I'm the master of that. So thanks for asking that. That's a great question.
Yeah.
So giving clarity.
What's that?
Giving it clarity.
Yeah.
Because sometimes I need clarity.
Well, I think you're like me. You've done a ton of things, and it's really easy to just like, did that, you know, I did that. And people are like, you did what? You know, like, they haven't been there with you, so they don't know this whole area of your life. Like, you went through, you said you were in education for like 16 years.
You're right.
And you did it in about, I don't know, 5 minutes. That's crazy to think that you can encapsulate that much life and that much learning, you know, in five minutes.
Yeah. Crazy.
So tell us, okay, so now what are you doing? So you're at UT, and tell us about the time at UT.
So at UT, basically I sold classes to companies, and usually it was in the areas of leadership, human resource, process mapping, Six Sigma, just all over the board. We did certifications in that area. So I sold and I trained. We were a cost recovery department, so we had to go out to clients and try to sell our training. The cool thing with the brand UT, people go, oh, UT, we are not worthy.
No, that's a good brand.
Yeah, and so it was very helpful in that. And so I actually sold and trained. And I found out that when I would teach a class, they're like, you're different, Bob. Why is that? And I said, well, there's a lot of reasons, but probably one of them is that I said, I really care about that people learn. I want them to leave saying, you know, I think I can use some. So I was in charge of that for 10 years at UT, and developed classes, became a strong advocate in this area where people would use the curriculum and it would be real active. That they wouldn't, I told my staff that it's so active that they're like, gosh, what happened to the day? Mm-hmm. I said, that's what we want to be known for, is that what happened to the day? And at the end, they come up and talk to you and say, so how do you do that? That's what our training, the two elements, is that it goes so fast that they're like, man, dude, this is really fast. And then they come up and talk to you and ask questions and say, how do I make this happen with my staff? And so, you know, I was able, my staff had great staff. We were able to build that brand, and people started seeing our department as kind of a great provider for learning, from leadership to communication to coaching, all those things. So it was really a fun journey.
Sounds like there. What school were you in? I didn't know. Like
the continuing ed department.
Okay.
Professional Development Center and Continuing Ed was what it was called.
Huh.
And so that's been around for like forever, still exists.
So that's a revenue center for the university?
So it's cost recovery. And what happens is they basically pay for the employees' benefits, but we pay for our salaries. And so, and we're part of the retirement system and everything. So, it was one of those where they weren't funded by the university, except for some things like building and et cetera, but the training brought in revenue. And plus some of the revenue was sent to the dean's office because they got a take of it. So
yeah, it sounds like the Sopranos, right? You gotta kick
out. Yeah. Come over here. Let me give you something. So that was, you know, I traveled a lot, and I, some of the clients I have today from them, I've known for, you know, 15 years, because they laid a bunch of us off for some reason. Maybe, I don't know. It could have been my behavior. I don't know.
You brought the whole thing down, Bob. You and your creativity and your wanting to create dialogue. Yeah, come on.
Well, and I think, you know, when we were laid off, it was like the top performers were laid off. And that was interesting. But we were the rebel rousers too. We questioned stuff. People don't like to be questioned. I love being questioned. Why are you doing that, Bob? I think it's interesting to be questioned.
Yeah, and universities, again, like my experience with universities, and I was at quite a few. I had a couple of long-term gigs, but I moved around a lot. And it was totally because that tension between creativity and innovation and thinkers, and you're going to get push. And that's supposed to be the idea of a super university, right? Like, we're just going to let these, you know, really smart people loose on problems, and they're going to fix a bunch of stuff. And then you get there, and then the administration and the realities of keeping alumni happy and students happy and everything else just slow it all down and make it conservative. And this side over here, the kinetic side, I found just got shrunk and shrunk and crushed and crushed and crushed to the point where I was like, I can't act like this for you guys anymore. And I love the idea of a university, but the reality, pragmatics that
right.
don't live up to it.
Yeah. And, you know, the question I asked them is that, you know, why were these top performers being laid off? I said, we brought in the most revenue, and did we behave ethically? They said, yes. I said, no, it's fair. And so I think what they were trying to tell me is there's some egos in the room, and Lewis, you need to learn political savviness. And that's what he said. And I got it. And questioning people of authority is not politically savvy. And my wife said, that's you, Bob. I get it.
You know, and I've got this as a note for us to talk about, because anytime you work for corporations, I resisted working for corporations for a long time because I'm a comic. I am a creative. I do not like conservatism because it stops the flow of many things. I respect the ideas of some of that stuff and why we need it, you know, but the play out of it in my life, especially when I want to say intellectual things and comic things, those don't work real well in a conservative environment. And so like with corporations, I've done a ton of stuff now with corporations over the years. And I started by doing comedy, which they're very afraid of. They like, if they get burned at all, they'll give you a contract the next time of you can't say this, can't talk about this, can't talk about this. And I kind of took it on as a fun writing project to go through my standard nightclub comedy show and extract bits I could do in corporations and rewrite them so that there was absolutely nothing offensive, not just like sex talk or obscenities and profanities, but also like no particularly, you know, conflicting ideas. Like I didn't even challenge, and I ended up with like 15 minutes. The first bit I wrote was 15 minutes on sleep, and it killed. It was, I could use it in comedy clubs. It was pure stand up, but it was just about how hard it is to get a good night's sleep, because you're always sleeping with somebody else and they do it wrong. And I went through it for 15 minutes. I'm like, that is super fun. Nobody can get offended, right, by me talking about sleep. But politically, finding those safe little spaces where you can still feel good about what you're doing, but it doesn't have political, you know, ramifications is hard.
Yeah, it's very hard. I have a company I work with, and they asked me to be two different people, Bob, and then if it's another class like sexual harassment, I have to be Bob Light, because I am edgy and they know it, that because their people are a little inappropriate at time. And so I egg it on, and I've worked for 15 years, but every once in a while they say, on this course, you need to be Bob Light.
That's great. That's perfect.
I love that company because they don't put up with some nonsense narratives of people outside the realm. That is who we are. And when they hire, that's who we are. And so you may not be a fit because we are kind of crazy and wild. We may drop a couple bomb words every once in a while. It's just part of it, you know, and they don't apologize, but they don't have many problems either. And it's kind of cool stuff.
Sounds like they hire correctly then, right?
They have used my, you know, this is my selling point, maybe not really, but they've used that behavioral interviewing process and they've stuck with it since 2005. I still teach it today, kind of a 3-hour course on behavioral interviewing. How do you write questions that are going to predict these behaviors? I mean, it's not that complicated, but we humans get in the mix. Wow. And they start questioning stuff. Yeah, come on, just set yourself free. Just breathe in. And they breathe in every day with it. And they found some cool people. And the result is in some of the classes, I've seen some of their new hires right away. And one of the things they measure is that we want employees speaking up the first day. It's measured. I can share a question if you want. You want me to share a question with you?
Sure, yeah.
So the question goes like this. What would you do if a manager criticized you for something you knew was right? So in your mind, Dan kind of answered that question. And what happens, I don't know if you want, do you want to ask me that question? I'll give you two different responses.
Sure.
I'll be the interviewee. So the question is, what would you do if a manager criticized you for something you knew was right?
Okay, Bob, you're yes, my sir. Interviewee, right?
I am, sir.
Okay, got a question for you. What would you do if a manager criticized you for something that you knew you had done that was right?
Right. Okay, first response. Let's pretend like maybe I'm Brad Pitt for some. So what I hear is a couple things. I hear one person say, this is typical answer on some cases. I would have good eye contact. I would help paraphrase when needed, and I would help them come to a solution. Okay, so put that in your head. Just listen to the content, not Brad. Now you're gonna ask Bob the same question.
All right, Bob, somebody manager criticizes you unfairly, you know you're right. What do you do?
Good question. What I would do is I'd want to talk to you and I'd want to share the information of what I worked on. And then if I was wrong, fine. But if I was right, I think in all fairness, I owe it to you. So what I'm measuring here is responsibility. And I ask 5 questions whenever I try to measure one behavior. What would be your guess of the person who is more responsible, Bob or Brad?
Well, it has to be Bob, right?
I mean, of course,
specifically
yeah.
what you're going to do, not the right. generic technique.
Right. And so what's interesting is they found out people they hired where they because a lot of it is what they would do is they didn't really stand up for their right in the first one. Brad didn't, but he makes more money, so he doesn't have to. But he didn't really stand up for what he was doing. And also Brad, I forgot to add in that question, he also said, I didn't say this, I forgot, brain freeze, is that he would change what his boss said to do. So that was the piece I left out, which is real important. But what they found out is that people, if they have that behavior to speak up day one, not to argue, but to speak up, that they didn't go around their back, that they had a face-to-face conversation.
Oh, yeah.
And so what's interesting is with behavioral interviewing, so what would you do if a manager criticized you for something you knew was right? People often about 48% say, oh, you know, my boss is right. I probably would just, you know, maybe redo some things and represent it. The highly responsible person, which I know I got all five questions, which has got me in trouble in life too. Okay. Is that I would speak up. I remember hiring a person at UT and he got all five questions on behavioral learning on responsibility. And I said something, he kind of raised his hand. He goes, can I share something? I'm not sure if I totally agree with what you're saying. And all the other employees went, whir. I said, no, remember when we hired Billy, Billy said he would speak up. He is doing it. I'd rather have him speak up. Of course, there are two people that didn't speak up in my crowd that would go around my back. But the other eight people that were responsible always came to me. I don't agree with you, Bob. As a manager, I want that. And this client that I have, they want that. They want people not to be afraid to share their new idea because they're paying them $100,000 salary. Day one, they should be so engaged. And they said, by speaking up and asking questions is their whole kind of cultural thing is speak up and ask questions. And managers taught, dial down your ego, man, because you're going to have employees question. We've hired these folks who do this.
Right.
Now, as a manager, you have to know how to navigate that. So, I mean, that's just kind of like a general piece, but that's why I love this, where you say, am I the expert? Yes, because I love writing questions that predict behavior. And then when that employee comes on, the manager goes, what they said in the interview, they're doing. I've never experienced that in my lifetime. And so, yeah, I mean, that if you were to get me a whole topic of this, it's just, I think it's life-changing for organizations that they can finally have a process, as you said, I think is really cool, in place that works instead of these random things.
No, I think that's great.
Just let me rattle a little bit.
No, that's great. I would give you my example, my Hollywood example, from about this. My first day ever at a paid writing job, like for it was called the Best Dance Sports Show period. It was on the Fox studio lot in Beverly Hills. Like, I'd done a bunch of other stuff kind of fragmented around Hollywood, but this first time full-time staff writing job. And I was supposed to be there at 9 a.m. for the morning meeting, so I left at 7. You know, this is the first time I'd driven across the Beverly Hills, the hills to getting down into Beverly Hills. There were two wrecks. I took a wrong direction. There was no GPS or, you know, phone back then. And I almost quit. I almost went back home, but I've made my way down there. I was a half hour late for my first day, first meeting. There's seven, you know, writers in there and the head writer and a producer sitting in. And I have to knock on the door and walk into the middle of this meeting. And I met one guy I knew from stand-up and everybody else I'd never met. I'd never met the head writer who had hired me. He hired me over the phone the night before. So you walk in, you know, 10 people in this room, never met you. What do you do? And so I walked in and was like, what the fuck, you started without me? Big laugh. Everybody's like, all right, come on in. I'm the new writer.
Awesome.
Because in comedy writing, like, those are the behaviors you're looking for in comedy writers. Fearless. Can improv in situations, can come up with great lines no matter what. And I'm like, I just got to go for it. I can't come in and apologize. I just, nah, you know.
Wow. That's authenticity at its best. That's cool. I love that story. Cause that's kind of like behavioral interviewing, right?
Yeah, that's exactly.
I mean, that's predictive.
Yeah. And you know, like with your organization, you know what you need. And now the question is, like, what you're putting in place is these nice processes of finding it. And in stand-up and comedy writing, especially in comedy writing, it's also a problem because their predictive stuff is like, you have to turn in writing samples and they read the writing sample to predict whether you can write for their show or not,
right?
Which is a bad process because that writing sample, you don't really know where it came from. Like, you can get friends to help you write stuff.
Right.
You know, there are people who will steal jokes and put them in the writing packet. And I see people all the time hire bad writers because of a good writing packet that wasn't actually theirs.
Yeah.
That's fascinating, cool, Bob. I like it. That's cool. You got that in your bag.
Yeah. It helped me with my daughter's boyfriends at time. and, you know, prom date, and they come in and I secretly ask a question. So my daughter would be like, "Dad, what are you doing?" Well, just making observations, my dear.
Just predicting behavior.
Right. I'm all about predicting behaviors. So yeah. And my kids have benefited from helping them with interviewing, you know, for jobs, and they've gotten really good jobs, and it's because of their good behavior too. I mean, I'm not going to take the credit for them, because, you know, in spite of me, and they turned out pretty cool kids.
So is that the main thing that you sold? Tell me about your other offerings, you know, to people when you go out. And
Sure. So I'm a big communication guy. I love teaching and you probably have heard it before, it's called NLP, Neuro-Linguistic Profile. It measures all the way up to hypnotism, but I don't do hypnotism. What it measures is how people receive information, how they process it, how they give it out. And what they do is they take this online assessment, which is just the cat's meow. They actually find out, how do I like to receive information? So when you come to me, Dan, and talk to me, I'm very visual and kinesthetic. I like to see it, and I like to stand up and move and think about it and walk through it. My wife is very auditory. I could yell some across the room. She'd remember all items. My auditory is low. She'd tell me to go get something. I might bring the dog down. She told me 10 things. So one thing I do is teaching people that, and I call it flexing your communication style. So when you approach people, you approach how they like to receive it, not how you like to receive it, because we're all different human beings running around. So that's one class I teach. I do a lot of around the areas of strength finders, because I kind of fell in love with that in the early 2000s. Because I think people, if they're in their strength, their potential is this much. If they're in their gap, it's this much. So I'm doing something this week for a client in North Carolina that is helping them really approach people based on what they do well, instead of trying to fix people. And the CEO says, "We're tired of fixing people, Bob. It ain't working. It never has. Now we're going to, it's a mindset." He said, "So don't expect miracles your first day of training, because it's a mindset. We have fixers." And so, you know, to me, it's a challenge because of that. And so, and I do, you know, I do a lot of things around HR stuff. I do coaching, but training in front of people is my love. Coaching people, and I love people, but sometimes I found out I just don't like the one-on-one coaching. And people say, "Oh, you're so good." I'm like, "I know, but I'm miserable." So yeah, maybe it takes
so much more battery to be able to focus and do a dialogue than to do, you know, mostly, you know, you always dialogue within monologues when you present, but it energizes me. Like one-on-one dialogues, they drain me.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, me too. Yeah. I can. And probably my next love is I'm big on Center for Creative Leadership out of North Carolina. They have a 360-degree feedback assessment. And those can be very dangerous, but the one I use now, it's very rich, and people, they're just saying it's life-changing for them. And so I actually have class where they get feedback from all their bosses and peers, and then six of us come together and we go through that profile. We do peer-to-peer coaching. I put them off with another person, and then they actually write goals that work. Because I remember I used to write goals and I put them in a filing cabinet, and a year later I go, "Oh, I made two by mistake. Awesome, Bob." But with these goals, there's some, they write them and they are so involved in it. So, you know, the areas of behavioral interviewing, strength finders, communication at 360, kind of what I tend to be doing more of. And when at the end of the day, when I finish it, it makes me tingle and quiver, you know, those kind of things.
It hits the things that you really do. It sounds like that you've carried across all these things, which is giving out good information, like putting together good information, recognizing what a good script is, what a good process is, and then finding a way to give it to people so that they can actually absorb it, instead of, you know, what so many people do, which is, this is one way of pouring the water and that's it. That's all I do. I don't care if they can drink it. I don't care if they have no other system. It sounds like you're adaptable, because your main thing is to get that good information into people. You don't care the system so much as that the result happens.
Right. That's very accurate. Yeah. Very, very accurate. That's kind of puts it in perspective. Me hadn't thought about it that way. Thanks for framing it that way. It's kind of like, you know, sometimes you wonder, what do you want to be when you want to grow up? And I never said I was going to be a corporate trainer. I was going to be a five. I said I was going to be a person who gave tours in Yellowstone, telling them all about the different rocks, because rocks are cool.
Right.
And so Yellowstone is my favorite place, one of them in the world besides Scotland. And just, I thought I always want to be a tour guide. So I guess kind of I am a tour guide now in a different way, tour guide at learning.
Yeah, it is. And that's why, you know, one of the reasons I do the podcast the way I do, where I interview comedians and people in politics and professionals all over the place, because it's all public talk. You know, it's all managing talk. It's all creating messages to try to accomplish something. And that's the idea of rhetoric. It's that instead of just frenetically throwing messages at something, it's, hey, let me sit back here first, figure out what will probably work best, design it, build it, and then I'll bring it over there. And that, just that, you know, thinking about it, designing it and building it before you bring it to people is, it's just life changing in so many ways. And when you think of tour guiding, like, I don't know if you've ever seen these things, like in New York, a lot of big cities have this where they'll have the double decker bus and then there's a tour guide on top. And a lot of stand-ups ended up giving these tours of the city because they would tell you about a place and they would give the information, but then they'd add all the humor in to punch it. And so once you do the tour 10 times, 50 times, 100 times as the tour guide, your script and your knowledge of all these places just becomes so pristine and so dimensional that you just add so much to it that nobody else could in the same way. And I think it is that way. Once you get really comfortable with your set of information, you start bringing so much flavor to it. And as long as you don't get burnt out on it.
Right. That's the ticket, especially in a Zoom environment. It's been a little bit more to navigate for me personally, just to be as engaged. But my Aunt Pesha said, had a lot of quips, you know. She'd always say, find the bless in the mess, you know. There's always a blessing in some mess. She always used to say, kind of crack me up, that if there was something going on in the family, she was kind of this positive, negative person, kind of cranky, but fun. And she'd always say to the people in the family, if something happened, she goes, is it a wet towel on the bed or a mugging? Choose. It's a wet towel on the bed. Quit thinking it's a mugging. I remember, mugging? I lived in Nebraska. I've never been mugged. I've had some wet towels on the bed.
That's so funny. Yeah. Your family, and you have a little bit of a David Sedaris quality to you. You ever read that guy's stuff?
No, not really, but I've heard of him.
Oh, he's great. And he takes ordinary stuff, ordinary life, and writes, you know, these essays about it. They're just hilarious because he notices things in there that nobody else notices. And just like that, like little sayings, you know, about normal life. And great.
Yeah. Had some weird family members, but boy, I tell you, it makes us who we are today. That's kind of cool. Builds our tapestry or something like that.
So where do you go from here? What's next in your progression? You just keep selling the same classes? Are you still learning different things that interest you? Are you trying to take this outside of corporate? What's going on?
That's a great question. And that's a question I'm really tumbling with today. Because, you know, I'm one of those individuals, people, you know, I retired once from Texas Parks and Wildlife, and then I started my own business. And my wife said, oh, you probably can't stop working. You're one of those, huh? And I said, you know, probably. I really think I would like to get back. And you talk about the millennial population. I did a lot of work around millennials. And when I did some global surveys worldwide, and two of the things that stood out, even though I have a couple millennial kids, is that, you know, it seems like it's what about me generation. But as I started unfolding and unwrapping some of the stuff about them, I felt like they just, they want to have purpose and they want to be grown and developed. Now they want to move up corporate ladder faster than those. But I think they're a population. One is I want them to do well, because if I'm going to retire, I need to count on them. So, you know, for me, I've had some people ask me, hey, I haven't asked somebody today asked me to come work for the university here. And I looked at it, I said, nah, I said, and why not? I wouldn't fit and I'd be in trouble. She goes, yeah, you would. I said, okay. But I think with the younger population doing it. So am I kind of that volunteer side, you know, the homeless people, the home people with the homeless can't think of a word. People who are homeless is an always interesting piece. I want to get my hands around that. As far as professional, I kind of want to do what I'm doing still, because I'm seeing companies change in the two areas I've noticed, and I've surveyed them, and they're communicating better and they're hiring better. So I think maybe I need to get better at it. I mean, it's a strength. So I could stay sedentary and not do anything. So I think I want to become stronger in those two areas. And what I need, so that's what I'm going to start doing. What I need to stop doing is, or stop doing is taking on projects that don't make me quiver or tingle, because I don't give my best. And I told a client that, I turned one down. I said, it won't be my best. Oh yeah, it will. They try to talk you into stuff because you did great in another class, but I may totally suck in that next class. And maybe it's my ego talking. I don't want to suck.
Well, I said it earlier. I think you've expressed, you know, consistently in this podcast that you like things to be good. You like quality. You like for it to have an effect. And I could see if you're going, maybe 50%, I could get it. You know, it's not going to be enough. You're not going to feel satisfied with that.
Bingo. Absolutely. How about you?
I think it's cool when people, you know, you spend so much of your time doing things just to make money to get by. But when you do find, you know, the things where you're like, oh, I love singing this song. It's like singers, right? Suddenly they find the right song. And you're like, man, they really can inhabit that song. And all the other stuff is terrible on their album. But that one, education in a lot of ways is the same thing. Like you find those really things, those things that you really groove with.
How about you?
Me?
What do you want to be when you grow up?
I want to be just what I am. I'm doing exactly what I want to do. I just want to make a lot more money with it. I like talking about intellectual stuff. I love exploring. I've been fascinated with rhetoric and managed communication ever since in my early 20s when I ran into it in grad school. I remember picking up a book as I was walking past the professor's office before classes even started, and he was giving away some of his old books. And I picked up this book, and it was latest research in persuasion or something like that. And it was a series of articles. And I'm like, all right. And I took it home and read the whole thing. And I had never taken a class in persuasion or rhetoric or anything else. I went to grad school in this. I'd never taken undergraduate at all in it. But as soon as I picked it up, I'm like, the idea that you could use intellectual process and language to move people towards things that are good for them, good for you, good for the group, fascinated me. Because it was suddenly like you could have effect with language instead of just trying, you know, and being frustrated. And so, you know, I love that stuff. And then managing it into comedy, merging it with humor is the second gear. Like, I just love doing that too. So, you know.
You have cool stuff. Just great insights. I've learned a lot.
This has been super fun, man.
Yes, absolutely.
I knew it would be. You have good energy, good insights. Thank you.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much for having me.
If people are listening to this, where can they find you if they want to, you know, hire you for millions of dollars for your training?
Oh, yeah, there you go. Well, BobLewisTraining@gmail.com is one. I could give you a website, but I'm taking it down because I think there's so many different ways to connect. So that's gone. 512-740-0889. And that's my number. You won't get spammed or anything like that, I promise. But yeah, I just, you know, we can laugh and learn. You know, my whole message is we can laugh and learn and come out at the end, maybe changing or shifting. We don't have to change. Maybe we just shift. If we can just shift something, I think the small shift happens. Make small shifts, things work out. At least I found that way. So thanks for having me. Awesome.
Yeah, man.
Awesome. Fun time.
Yeah. I like I said, I just, when I find people that I find interesting or amusing or valuable, I just grab them and say, hey, come on the podcast and talk. And they're always like, what would I talk about? And I'm like, you'll be fine.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me. It was great.
All right, man. That has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Get out there and persuade some people, because as always, you know, they need it.